Today, we're going to look at the fourth book of Moses, called Numbers, and touch on some of the more interesting things here and occurrences that took place while the Israelites were in the wilderness, and of course some of the key numbers of this book. Now, as I know, we read through, you know, the Bible each year with the Bible reading programs, and you know, there's some things that you might just skip over, but today we're going to look a little bit more in detail with some of the things. And it's the Numbers is a pretty long book, so this is actually going to be Numbers Part 1. And then I'll do another one on there to finish the rest of it. But as stated, the author of the book was Moses. It was written between 1444 and 1405 B.C. The name of the book, Numbers, is actually derived from the two recordings of the numbering of the Israelites, being called in the Greek version, arithmoi, and in the Vulgate, numeri. The more accurate title is the Hebrew title for this book, Bimidbar. Bimidbar, taken actually from the very first words in the book, in the wilderness, or in the Midbar. So the Hebrews call it Bimidbar, and we call it Numbers. Now, Numbers presents an account of the 38-year period of Israel's wandering from Mount Sinai to the plains of Moab on the border of Canaan. Now, the events of the book began in the second year after the Israelites departed Egypt as they camped at Mount Sinai around 1444 B.C. In Numbers chapter 1, we're going to be in Numbers the whole time. Numbers chapter 1 and verse 1 says, "Now the Eternal spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai in the tabernacle of meeting. On the first day of the second month, in the second year after they had come out of the land of Egypt." So it was exactly 1 year and 1 month after the Exodus. Now, God instructs Moses to take a census of all the men. In verse 3, it says from 20 years old and above, basically all who were able to go to war in, you know, for Israel. Here's established the heads of each of the household of each tribe, 12 in all, with Joseph represented by both his sons Ephraim and Manasseh, excluding the tribe of Levi, as they have other duties that's going to be involved in with the tabernacle. Now, each tribe is numbered with the tribe of Judah actually having the most fighting men at 74,600. And Joseph's two sons, actually Ephraim and Manasseh, they total 72,700. Now, the least is Manasseh at 32,200, but as I said before, he's kind of half of Joseph. So really, Benjamin, the tribe of Benjamin, is really the lowest with 35,400 soldiers. So there were 603,550 fighting men with their wives, children, men unable to fight, in addition to the Levites who worked with the tabernacle. So you can see that there could be more than 2 million people wandering the desert. That's not counting the mixed multitude of people that left with them as well. Now, many Bible scholars try to dismiss this notion, explaining that they they had different standards for counting back then, or the words that they used in the Bible meant something else. Some theories say there were only 60,355 fighting men, and therefore maybe around 350,000 total people leave in Egypt. It's estimated that Egypt, at the time of the Exodus, had a population of 4 million people. 4 million people in Egypt. So how many were there? How many were there? When we look at what the scripture says about the population, it makes sense there was a very large number of people. In Egypt, the Pharaoh was very concerned about their numbers. He's very concerned about their numbers. In Exodus chapter 1 and verse 9, "And he said to his people, 'Look, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we.'" More and mightier than we. In verse 10, it says, "Now come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply, and it happen in the event of a war that they also join our enemies and fight against us, and so go up out of the land." So Pharaoh was concerned because there was a lot of them. A lot. Even says more than them. Now in Exodus chapter 12 and verse 37, you see that then the children of Israel journeyed from Rasmus to Sukkoth, about 600,000 men on foot, beside children. In verse 38, "A mixed multitude went up with them also, and flocks and herds and a great deal of livestock." No one knows for sure how many left Egypt and wandered in the wilderness. It could have been 500,000 up to 2.5 million people. But we know that the scriptures make it very clear that it was a lot of people. A lot of people. Now the problem for most of these biblical scholars and also archaeologists who actually disagree with the number of people that left is because they can't find any evidence of it. The reason that they can't find any evidence is because they're looking at the wrong time and the wrong place. They continue to look around the time of Ramses, around 1200 BC. And they also are looking in the Sinai Peninsula. They should be looking around 1445 BC and the Arabian Desert, where they actually went. But because they're off by 250 some years and looking in the wrong place, they don't find evidence of it, and that's why they dismiss it. Now going into chapter 2, now chapter 2 of Numbers, it kind of shows the arrangement of the camp as the tribes are organized into four groups. The four main standards around surrounding the tabernacle, those of Ephraim, Judah, Reuben, and Dan, probably carried the emblems, as I mentioned before in my message on tribal standards. The emblems was of a bull, a lion, a man, and an eagle, respectively. And this is fascinating, of course, because these are the respective faces of the four living creatures surrounding God's throne in heaven, according to Revelation chapter 4 and verse 7. And also the cherub all have these faces that we see in Ezekiel chapter 1 and verse 10. And as I mentioned before, I talked about that before, so I'm not going to carry on with that too much. So let's go on to chapter 3. Chapter 3 is the numbering of the Levites. Now the Levites totaled 22,000 men who were able to serve God with the Ark of the Covenant and with the tabernacle and other duties relating to the movement and setup of the holy things. Now chapter 4, it continues with the numbering of the sons of Levi and their duties. Chapter 5 covers an interesting offering called a trial of jealousy, otherwise known as trial by ordeal. Trial by ordeal. This strange offering was performed when a man believed that his wife had been unfaithful to him. But he could not prove it. He only suspected her of being unfaithful. Now the wife, whether she was guilty or innocent, would actually have to go through this ordeal of drinking holy water to see if God would judge her. Now I know it seems cruel, but back then this would actually protect a wife from falsely being divorced and left in destitute. She was actually able to prove her innocence through this. But it's interesting in this kind of a setting with the Israelites and even Judah at the time of Christ, the men are always the most dominant here based on, you know, biblical principles, but I think sometimes they maybe have taken a little bit too far. But you notice that the woman can't accuse her husband of being unfaithful. And even when the adulteress was brought before Jesus, it was the woman. Where was the man? So maybe a double standard there, I don't know. But anyways, that's what this is actually covering, is this trial by ordeal. If the woman was innocent, it was to her benefit. Chapter 6 deals with the vows of the Nazarite. Now, Nazarite actually means separated one. Separated one. The vow of a Nazarite involved these three things here. Abstinence from wine and strong drink. Refraining from cutting the hair off the head during the whole period of the continuance of the vow. And the avoidance of contact with the dead. Now this was only done for a short time, and then they would cut off their hair and burn it and make offerings and then go back to normal life. Now there are mentions, it's mentioned made in the scriptures, of only three men who were Nazarites for life. Samson, of course, was one of them in Judges chapter 13, verse 4 and 5. Samuel was another one in verse in 1 Samuel verse 1 and or chapter 1 and verse 11. He was actually made a Nazarite by his mom in the prayer. And of course John the Baptist was another of these Nazarites in Luke chapter 1 verse 15, and they were Nazarites for life. In its ordinary form, however, a Nazarite's vow lasted only about 30 days and at the most 100 days. Even in the New Testament, it appears that some took these type of vows as well. It appears that Paul made vows also. In Acts chapter 18 and verse 18, so Paul still remained a good while. Then he took leave of the brethren and sailed for Syria, and Priscilla and Aquila were with him. And he had cut his hair off. And his hair was cut off at Cenchre, for he had taken a vow. So he took some type of a vow, since there was a cutting of the hair, it seems like it might have been a Nazarite type vow that he had taken. In Acts chapter 21, in verse 23, also here, it says, "Therefore, do what we tell you. We have four men who have taken a vow." Now this is Paul again, saying, "We have four men, I have four men here that have taken a vow. Take them to be purified with them and pay their expenses so they may shave their heads, that they may know that all the things of which they were informed concerning you are nothing, but that you yourself also walk according or orderly and keep the law." So here's another example of four men that took this type of a vow as well when they were going to the temple to shave their heads off, burn it, and do whatever else that they needed to do for this ritual here. Now at the end of chapter 6 here in Numbers is the Aaronic benediction, or what some call the priestly blessing. Have you heard this before? Many times. But in Numbers chapter 6 and verse 22, it says, "The Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to Aaron and his sons, saying, This is the way that you should bless the children of Israel. Say to them," and this is the benediction here, or the priestly blessing. And I'm going to, and usually I always replace Lord with Eternal, but I'm just going to read it as it is here because it's the one you always hear. "The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace." And so they put my name on the children of Israel and I bless them. So that's the one that you always hear a lot of times. You know, priests will do that little benediction over somebody and everything else. And that's where this actually comes from. Now, I'm not a Vulcan like Spock, and I know I'm not a Vulcan because I can't do this. You know, I have to tape these fingers together, you know, and I'm a big Star Trek fan, so everybody teases me because I can't do the Vulcan sign. But actually, when the priest were doing this over somebody, that's the sign that they would make, and that's where, you know, the actor, you know, Leonard Nimoy actually got that because he peeked when they were doing this ceremony one time and he saw that they were doing it, and that's where he came up with that idea for that symbol. But this is actually what they did when they said the blessing over somebody. And another interesting find that recent find about this too, about this blessing, was silver coins. They found these silver coins south of Jerusalem with these inscriptions on them, dating from the time when Babylon actually destroyed Jerusalem, which was around the 7th century B.C. when they actually came in there and conquered them. What's interesting about that is a lot of people try to say that Numbers was written in the 3rd century. They don't want to give credit to Moses. They don't want to, you know, of course they don't want to give credit to nobody. But these inscriptions were on coins that far back. So just another thing there to kind of debunk what all the archaeologists are trying to say. They don't want to believe when these things were written. So just a little tidbit there. Now, in chapter 7 and 8, it deals mostly with a lot of the offerings and also tabernacle duties. And I'm not going to go through all those. You can read those yourself. But it does mention one thing that's very important, and that is the laying on of hands in Numbers chapter 8 and verse 10. Now, I want to read from the United Church of God's commentary, and I will be referring to that quite often here as well. I always check that when I'm going through some of these things to make sure that I'm on the right path here. But from the, you know, from the commentary, it says, "The purpose of laying on of hands mentioned here is to set someone apart for a specific purpose, such as ordinations and also healings." The first mention of laying on of hands is in the scripture is when Israel or Jacob actually placed his blessing and his name on Ephraim and Manasseh. You know, all the way back in Genesis chapter 48, verse 13, that's the first example of laying on of the hands to pass that blessing on. And in the case of the Levites here, we see representatives of all of Israel laying their hands to set the Levites apart for a special service of the tabernacle in verse 10. The laying on of hands, according to the book of Hebrews, is one of the basic doctrines of the Bible. And that's Hebrews chapter 6, verse 1 and 2. One of the very basic things of the basic doctrines of the Bible, laying on hands. Now, continuing on with chapter 9, it gives more instructions here for the Passover service. But it also mentions here a second Passover ceremony for those who were unable to due to sickness or uncleanliness. In Numbers chapter 9:11, on the 14th day of the second month, at twilight, they may keep it, and they shall eat it with unleavened bread and bitter herbs. So when is it? When is this second Passover? How do you determine when the second Passover is? Well, it's fairly easy. To determine it, all you have to do is just add 4 weeks and 2 days to the first Passover. And that is your second Passover. 4 weeks and 2 days, and now you're at that second Passover, if that is needed. Now, a remarkable thing that's mentioned here at the end of chapter 9 is once the tabernacle in the wilderness was finally raised up and constructed, God's presence actually came down and hovered over the tabernacle. And it did that as a cloud by day and like a pillar of fire at night. And it stayed there. You would look up and you knew that God's presence was there. When God's presence moved, they packed up and followed it. When it stopped, they would set up the tabernacle again right there. So that's amazing that they were seeing that this whole time. Chapter 10 deals with a numbered item. Here's one of the numbers. The number two. In Numbers chapter 10 and verse 2, it says, make 2 silver trumpets for yourself. You shall make them of hammered work, and you shall use them for calling the congregation and for directing the movement of the camps. Now, the 2 silver trumpets were used to signal the entire encampment. I won't go into it too much, as we always hear about this on the Feast of Trumpets. And they were really designed for blowing of trumpets on that feast day. So it's very interesting that this is where it mentions it here. Also here in chapter 10, now they finally set off towards the promised land. On 20th day of the second month. Now it's the 20th day of the second month, they're finally leaving the wilderness of Sinai. They're leaving the mountain there where God gave them the law. 3 days later, in chapter 11, 3 days later in chapter 11, they make camp and immediately start complaining again. Especially the mixed multitudes this time, because they remembered the food in Egypt and they crave it desperately. In Numbers chapter 11 and verse 4, now the mixed multitudes who were among them yielded to intense craving. So the children of Israel also wept again and said, who will give us meat to eat? We remember the fish which we ate freely in Egypt, and the cucumbers and the melons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic. But now our whole being is dried up. There's nothing at all except this manna before our eyes. Now, we know that they had flocks of livestock, you know, sheep, goats, cattle. But they kept them, you know, for other things, for milk, you know, other dairy products that they might have made, and for sacrifices to God. If they would have ate all the livestock, they would really be in, they'd really be hurting for food. However, they wanted meat to eat instead of manna, which God was providing for them. They apparently had not learned the lesson, and their attitude displeased God once again. In fact, verse 10 says, Moses was also displeased. God brought disciplinary judgment upon them again, this time by giving them exactly what they asked for. You asked for it, you got it. In response to their disobedient and ungrateful attitude, God told Moses to tell the people in verse 18, therefore the Eternal will give you meat, and you shall eat until it comes out of your nostrils and becomes loathsome to you, because you have despised the Eternal who is among you, and have wept before him, saying, why did we ever come up out of Egypt? Now, even after this warning, they did not get the point. If I heard this, I'd be afraid to eat the meat that was coming. But not them. They didn't get the point. When God brought the quail, in verse 32 it says, and the people stayed up all that day, all that night, and all the next day and gathered the quail. The quail was this everywhere. Some of it almost sounds like it was knee deep. It just spread out all over the place. They were just going there and they were dead. They came, they died. They were just picking them up and gathering them up for days. The lust and unrepentant attitude of the people brought the judgment of God upon them. In verse 34 states, so he called the name of that place Kibroth Hattaavah, which means graves of lust. Graves of lust. Because there they buried the people who had yielded to the craven. So God did not bring judgment on the people for eating the quail, but because of their lustful and ungrateful hearts. Now, an interesting thing that I got from PubMed.gov. There's a toxicological syndrome which occurs during the migration of quails from the north when they fly down to the south and their migration period, because along the way they consume hemlock seeds. Now, the clinical term for this is acute rhabdomyolysis, which has a wide range of etiologies. Okay, now cotornism is a rare cause of acute, you know, rhabdomyolysis that can be lethal due to renal failure and shock. Cotornism from quail consumption has a combination of symptoms which include muscle tenderness, extremity pain, nausea, and vomiting. It can lead to death in some cases. Now, this epidemic in verse 33 is described as one of a very great plague, a very great plague. Now, the word used for plague here is makah, makah, which means a blow, a wound, or a slaughter. Now, this is not a common word that the Bible uses here for disease here in the Old Testament. When it is used, though, it implies that the disease referred to is divine punishment. It's a divine punishment. It was very sudden, associated with eating the quail meat from the dead bodies of the birds, which had been spread out around the camp and cured by drying in the sun, and was kept to up to a month before eating it became loathsome. The reaction from eating too much was marked from severe vomiting, even through the nostrils of the affected, which the scriptures say it's going to come out your nostrils, and it did. That's how severe the vomiting is. Those that died were said to have been greedy for meat, and that's according to the Revised English Bible in verse 34, greedy for meat, or to have felt a gluttonous craving for the quail meat. It had a fatal outcome for some of the people. For potluck today, we're having quail. Just kidding. It's actually chicken, but, you know. But yeah, so this is, you know, the thing is, it wasn't so much that they were eating the quail, it was just that they were making themselves gluttons of it and greedy for it, and they paid the price. Many died. Numbers chapter 12. Numbers chapter 12 and verse 1. Then Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Ethiopian woman whom he had married. For he had married an Ethiopian woman. So they said, has the Eternal indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us also? And the Eternal heard it. The Eternal heard it. God was upset, and he left. He left. He left the building. His cloud went up and left the tabernacle. He was upset. And when the cloud departed, in verse 10, and when the cloud departed from above the tabernacle, suddenly Miriam became leprous, as white as snow. Then Aaron turned toward Miriam, and there she was, a leper. Verse 13, so Moses cried out to the Eternal, saying, please heal her, O God, I pray. Now this was definitely here a family squabble. And Aaron and Miriam may have been jealous of their younger brother, Moses. It is foolishness, as Miriam herself is referred to as a prophetess in Exodus 15 verse 20. And God actually talked to them and also talked to Aaron. This really shows that we should never speak evil against others, especially those that are ordained by God. Now the thing is with this Ethiopian woman, there's a lot of speculations here that this might have been somebody even before he left Egypt. As he was raised in Egypt and was a prince, and there's stories from Josephus and others that say that he actually fought a war as like almost like a general or something like that for Egypt at the time with Ethiopia, and they made a peace treaty, and he married one of the daughters of the king down there, and they got a name for her as well. And it's something that's also depicted in Cecil B. DeMille's The Ten Commandments, when he first comes there and Ethiopia comes and the one girl's there, and you know, she's sitting there and she looks like she's a little sweet on Moses, and Nefertari, she's kind of jealous, like, who's this woman? Well, I mean, they threw that in there because it's quite possible that he was did get married before, so this was a wife from before that might have been part of that mixed multitude that went with them. Unsure about that, but the thing is Miriam was the one that was leading this charge. That's why she became a leper and not Aaron, but they were both wrong in that way, and they did learn a lesson from that. Now, Numbers chapter 13 has another number here that we're going to talk about. The number 12. 12 spies. In Numbers chapter 13, verses 1 through 2, let me open up here and read this along with you. Numbers 13, verse 1, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Send men to spy out the land of Canaan, which I am given to the children of Israel. From each tribe of their fathers you shall send a man, every one a leader among them. Okay, so Moses is sending out these spies now. Now in verse 16, there's an interesting thing here now. Verse 16 says, these are the names of the men whom Moses sent out to spy the land. And Moses called Hosea, the son of Nun, Joshua. Okay, so he changes his name here. I'm not going to read the other people, but this was interesting here. Hosea, in Hebrew, Hosea meant salvation, or it also means may the Eternal save. May the Eternal save. Moses changes it to Joshua, which is the Hebrew, the Eternal saves. The Eternal saves. Thus, actually providing an answer to the request in his former name, which I think is kind of unique. Now, of course, the Latinized Greek form of Joshua is Jesus. Indeed, Joshua was a type of Jesus Christ in many respects. Now Caleb, his buddy Caleb, that he also had a very appropriate name as well. His name carries the sense of being bold or wholeheartedness in Hebrew. Now their mission was very simple. Their mission was simple. Discover the quality of the land, the quality of the produce, the quality of the people, and their military might. That's what they were to do. Now in verse 25, it shows that they were there for 40 days, spying out the land. Spying out the land for 40 days. In verse 27, they had returned, and they said, then they told them and said, we went to the land where you sent us. It truly flows with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. They brought back fruit. Nevertheless, the people who dwell in the land are strong. The cities are fortified and very large. Moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. Yikes. So this is the report that 10 of the spies give this really bad report. In verse 30, then Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, let us go up at once and take possession, for we are well able to overcome it. So Caleb, he was ready to go, as well as Joshua was. Now in verse 31, it says, but the men who had gone up with him said, we are not able to go up. It says we. Notice we. We are not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we. Okay, twice they say we. They're stressing this we. Did they forget about God? Apparently they did. And they gave the children of Israel a bad report of the land. which they had spied out, saying, the land through which we have gone is as a spy, is as a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people whom we saw in it were men of great stature. There we saw the giants. The descendants of Anak came from the giants. And we were like grasshoppers in our own sight. And so we were in their sight. They're like insects compared to these. Now the Anak, or the Anakim, were a formidable race of giants. They were warlike. There's mention of them in Deuteronomy chapter 2, verse 10 and 21, and also Deuteronomy chapter 9 and verse 2. They occupied the land, the lands that were in southern Israel near Hebron, before the arrival of the Israelites. There's mention of that in Joshua chapter 15, verse 13. Now, the Anakim's ancestry has been traced back to Anak, the son of Arba. And that's in Joshua chapter 15, verse 13, if you want to jot it down. Also 21, verse 11. Now, the sons of Arba, they were at the time regarded, he was regarded as one of the greatest men among the Anakim. In fact, Hebron, the city of Hebron, that they renamed Hebron after one of the sons of or descendants of Levi, the name of the place was Kiriath Arba, and they renamed it to Hebron. So actually, during the conquest of Canaan, we'll talk a little bit more about this, these people, when they finally did go in 40 years later or whatever, the conquest, Joshua actually expelled the Anakim from the hill country, and Caleb finally drove them out of Hebron completely. However, a small remnant found refuge in the cities of Gaza, Gath, and Ashdod. And that's in Joshua chapter 11, verse 22, that mentions that there were some of them out there that they got away. Which is very interesting, because many Bible scholars speculate that Anakim's descendants were the Philistine giants David encountered in 2 Samuel 21, verses 15 through 22, including Goliath of Gath, mentioned in 1 Samuel 17, verses 4 and 7. So that's where they went, this giant race, they went in to Gaza, Gath, and Ashdod. And of course, Goliath was from Gath, so he could have been a descendant from this race of giants, or just very tall men. On to Numbers 14 as we continue on with this whole thing. So all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night. They got the bad report. They believed the bad report. Joshua and Caleb's voices were drowned out by the other ten. They were scared. In verse 2, and all the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron, and the whole congregation said to them, if we had only died in the land of Egypt, or if we had only died in this wilderness. Notice verse 4. So they said to one another, let us select a leader and return to Egypt. They wanted to select a new leader and return to Egypt. They complained against Moses and Aaron and preferred dying or going back to Egypt. Moses and Aaron fell on their faces fell on their faces, and Caleb and Joshua, they tore their clothing. They rended their clothing, and which is associated with mourning, grief, and loss, which was done many times as an outward expression in the Bible. They blamed God. They actually blamed God instead of trusting Him. They actually accused God here of putting their families in harm's way. In harm's way. In verse 3 it says, "Why has the Lord brought us into this land to fall by the sword, that our wives and children should become victims?" They blame God for putting their family, their children in harm's way. This is big. This is big. First of all, God is absolutely amazed at their reaction, especially after all they had witnessed. All the miracles, the crossing of the Red Sea, all these different things that He did for them. God is also so angry that He wants to just wipe them all out and start all over again with Moses. Verse 11, "Then the Eternal said to Moses, 'How long will this people reject me? How long will they not believe me with all the signs which I have performed among them? I will strike them with pestilence and disinherit them, and I will make you a nation greater and mightier than they.' Then Moses has to plead with God to spare the stubborn nation again. Moses doesn't seek preeminence for himself. Yeah, he could have been all gone and could have started all over with him. He did not seek preeminence for himself. He was a servant. Rather, he is primarily concerned with God's reputation. Very concerned with God's reputation. He reminds the Eternal that the nations are watching. Nations know that you brought us out. He was concerned that, you know, he doesn't want the nations to see that He brought them out just to kill them all. He was concerned about that. Moses comes to their aid and appeals to God's patience and mercy. Moses here actually acts as a type of Christ in obtaining a pardon for the people. God answers them. In verse 20, "Then the Lord said, 'I have pardoned according to your word. But truly, as I live, all the earth shall be filled with the glory of the Eternal. Because all these men who have seen my glory and the signs which I did in Egypt and in the wilderness, and would have put me to the test now these 10 times, I have not heeded my voice. And certainly they shall not see the land which I swore to their fathers, nor shall any of those who reject me see it.'" Now, an interesting thing here, these 10 times, it's a Hebrew idiom. These 10 times means over and over again. So it might not be literally 10 times, but it was just an idiom meaning over and over again, these 10 times. Kind of like how we say, the whole 9 yards. Now in verses 26 through 38, God tells Moses that these people who did not trust him would die in the wilderness and not see or enter the land that was promised. Only Joshua and Caleb would. The punishment was to wander for 40 years in the wilderness, so all those who rejected God would actually perish. The next day, some of them, now God says, you ain't going in there now. But some of them decided they were going to go. Oh, we changed our mind. We want to go now anyways, you know, without the approval of God. They decided to go without Moses, without the Ark of the Covenant. And they went, and they were defeated immediately and ran for their lives. They just don't get it. Now, another tidbit about this event is very interesting. It's something that's called Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av, or the ninth of Av, is a full day of fasting and mourning among the Jews nowadays. The month of Av usually falls around the height of summer. This year will actually be July 18th this year. But the ninth of Av is like the saddest day in the Jewish calendar. The rabbis held that this was preordained to be a day of tragedy for the Jewish people. The Talmud states that God marked this day for tragedy because of the incident here in Numbers chapter 13 and 14 that took place in the wilderness on this day. Moses had sent the spies to scout out the promised land, and based on their frightened report, the people wept at the prospect of entering such a formidable land of full of giants. So God declared to them, "You wept without cause. I will therefore make this an eternal day of mourning for you." This is according to the Talmud. So on or about this very same day here, which is interesting, both the first temple and the second temple were destroyed on this very same day. That's why they make this a big day of mourning. Not only did they reject going into the Holy Land at that time, both the first temple and the second temple were destroyed on this very same day in history. Also, a major battle at Beitar was lost, and also the plowing of the temple grounds occurred on this day. Years later, after they destroyed the temple, they came back and they plowed over it on this very same day. The Jews also state that, and history shows that England, actually the nation of England, expelled them on that very day in 1290, and Spain also banished the Jews on that very same day in 1492. Another interesting tidbit is World War I. World War I, which really didn't end, it was a continuous thing. There was this little break, which ended in World War II, of the killing of all the Jews and the Holocaust, all that. But World War I actually kicked off, officially kind of kicked off, when Germany declared war against Russia, and then France 2 days later. And yes, the 9th of Av was the day in between those two declarations of war when it began. The Jews still hold a fast on this day and always look to future tragic events that may actually occur on this day. A little tidbit of information there. Numbers 15 begins with a grain and drink offerings, and then explains unintentional sinning, which can be remedied. Now, according to the United Church of God's commentary, deliberate sins are sinning presumptuously, literally with a high hand, in a sense, defiantly shaking one's fist at God's face, was another matter entirely. Okay? It merited a severe penalty. Following in the chapter is an example of such a situation, and that was a man deliberately working on the Sabbath. He was picking up some sticks. The people did not know how to deal with such a willful breaking of the commandments, so they temporarily incarcerated him until they could get further instructions. The law already stated that he should die in Exodus 31, verse 15, but the means of death was not described. So God told Moses that the man should die outside the camp at the hands of the people by stoning. This way Israel would participate in and realize the severity of the punishment and absoluteness of God's commandments. Now today, of course, there is no one is executed for breaking the Sabbath. But God has already shown us his decreed penalty and exactly how he feels about the need to obey his laws. Indeed, the penalty of all of our sin is ultimately is death. Romans 6:23. Number 16. Korah's rebellion. Number 16, verse 1. Now Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, with Dathan and Abiram, and the sons of Eliab, and On, the son of Peleth, the sons of Reuben, took men. And they rose up before Moses with some of the children of Israel, 250 leaders of the congregation, representatives of the congregation of men renowned. They gathered together against Moses and Aaron and said to them, "You take too much upon yourselves, for all the congregation is holy, every one of them, and the Eternal is among them. Why then do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Eternal?" Here we go again. Now, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, they mentioned something that's interesting here. Now, Korah, this leader here, Korah, the son of Izhar, Izhar, his brother is Amram in Exodus 6:18, if you want to write that down. And Amram is the father of Aaron, Miriam, and Moses. Actually making Korah their first cousin. This is their first cousin. Now, Izhar, now he was the second son of Kohath. And for some reason, unrecorded, he has been supplanted by a descendant in the fourth son of Kohath, because Elizaphan, the son of Izuel, another brother of Izhar, was appointed as the chief or the prince of the Kohathites. And that's in Numbers 3, verse 30, when they're placing the leaders of the different groups. This guy, he's like the fourth, descended from the fourth son of Kohath. So there's some belief that there was some little bit of discontent over the preferment of a younger relative, which probably was kind of the cause of the seditious movement on the part of Korah, because he kind of felt like, you know, he got passed over in authority and he should be the chief. Now the thing is the, now Albert Barnes's notes on the Bible, he says that even being a Kohathite, he was one of the divisions of the Levites that had a most honorable charge. They were in charge of a lot of the things with the tabernacle. They had special duties. Yet it was Elizaphan who had been made the chief of the families of the Kohathites, you know, belonging to the youngest branch, descendant from Izuel. So Korah probably regarded himself as injured and therefore took the lead in this rebellion. Of the others, On is never mentioned again. He might have chickened out. You know, he started it, but you don't mention, he's never mentioned again. He probably withdrew from the conspiracy. You know, now Dathan and his brother Abiram, as well as On, now they were Reubenites. Now remember, Reuben was the firstborn son of Jacob and lost the birthright. So they probably discontented because they had lost the birthright. It was taken away from their ancestor. And with the primacy of their own tribe among the tribes of Israel. Now, an interesting thing about Dathan and his brother Abiram, they were the sons of Eliab of the tribe of Reuben. Now, these are the two other of the leaders of Korah's rebellion against Moses. These two have many, many, many tales told about their lives, even before this event. Their brother, they had a brother named Nemuel. He didn't participate in the rebellion with their brothers. Now, in rabbinic literature, Dathan, together with his brother Abiram, were among the quarrelsome and seditious personages in Egypt and in the wilderness, and sought on every occasion to place difficulties in the way of Moses. There are stories about them as the Hebrews that began to spread the tale of Moses killing the Egyptian, causing him to flee in the first place. Some say that Dathan might have even been the victim that he was saving. There's also stories about them being Hebrew taskmasters over their own people. And to every single rebellious encounter that they had with Moses and Aaron, from leaving Egypt and in the wilderness. So there's a lot of tales, many, many stories, many tales. These tales were so widespread that Cecil B. DeMille's epic film, The Ten Commandments, included him as a main character, a main protagonist and character. Dathan, of course, he was played by Edward G. Robinson, and his brother Abiram is played by Frank DeCova. So he was very prominent in history, so it was interesting that they had him in there always, you know, trying to get the people to go the other way. So in Numbers chapter 16 and verse 4, so when Moses heard it, he fell on his face, and he spoke to Korah and all of his company, saying, "Tomorrow morning the Eternal will show who is his and who is holy, and will cause them to come near him. That one whom he chooses will cause to come near him. Do this. Take censers, Korah and all your company, and put fire in them. Put incense in them before the Eternal tomorrow, and it shall be that the man whom the Eternal chooses is the Holy One. You take too much upon yourselves, you sons of Levi." Kind of like getting back at him. They mentioned that against them. Now he's saying that. Now apparently they've totally forgot about what happened to Aaron's two sons when they decided to offer strange fire before God. They must have also forgot about what happened to Miriam and Aaron when they questioned Moses' authority that was given to him by God. They wanted power. They were not satisfied with the Levite duties that were given to them. They wanted to be the priest. That's what it really was. They wanted to be the priest. In verse 20, it says, "The Eternal spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, separate yourselves from among this congregation, and I might consume them in a moment. Then they fell on their faces and said, O God, the God of spirits and all flesh, shall one man sin and you be angry with the whole congregation?" Again, here's Aaron and Moses pleading to God for the people. So the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the congregation, say, get away from the tents of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram." Or Abiram. Big trouble is coming. In verse 28. And Moses says this, "By this you shall know that the Eternal has sent me to do all these works, for I have not done them at my own will. If these men die naturally like all men, or if they are visited by the common fate of all men, then the Eternal has not sent me. But if the Eternal creates a new thing, and the earth opens its mouth and swallows them up with all that belongs to them, and they go down alive into the pit, then you will understand that these men have rejected the Eternal." They're going down into the pit. Verse 31. Now it came to pass, as he finished speaking all these words, that the ground split apart under them, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them and their households and all the men with Korah and all their goods. So they all went down, all those alive, into the pit, and the earth closed over them, and they perished from among the assembly. Happened exactly the way he said it was going to. Now the pit is the Hebrew word Sheol. Sheol. Which also means the grave or hell. Now biblical scholars like to mess around with this one, of course. They say it's proof that there's hellfire under the earth where the sinners go. Especially since after that a fire came all of a sudden and consumed the 250 men who offered incense. However, some agree that this only means the grave or the pit. And the reason is unbelievable too, but the reason they don't, they believe that it was just a grave or a pit as it says, is because they don't believe that God would send innocent children to hell because of the sins of their father. The reasoning is flawed, and it's just because they have a false belief in what hell is. But the earth opened up and it swallowed them alive. Now this is interesting. This is actually portrayed in the Ten Commandments movie as well, but not in this context. It was more in the context of the punishment for the golden calf. You see, you know, all that happened. It didn't happen that way, of course. That was a different punishment that God gave to them, but there was, you know, so much dramatization here that they used this event to actually show, you know, this visual event. It gives us an idea of what it might have looked like when Dathan and his brother and everybody else, they were swallowed up. So it actually, they got that right, that Dathan went down into the pit, but it was not that way. But it's kind of interesting. It gives us a little bit of an idea of how that happened. Now, Eleazar, the priest, Aaron's son, he was instructed to take the bronze censers, the ones that were, they were burned up, the people that were, you know, the 250 that used those censers. They took these bronze censers and he hammered it out and he put it on the covering of the altar to be a memorial to the children of Israel, that no outsider who was not a descendant of Aaron should ever come near the incense before the Eternal. However, the people did not learn their mistakes. You know, they don't know how to learn their mistakes from themselves and from others. Again, they complain, and it almost gets them all killed. To summarize this, again, from the United Church of God's commentary, you know, summarized in verses 41 and 50. Basically, it's astonishing that the congregation complains against Moses and Aaron the next day, blaming them for killing God's people. Blaming them for killing God's people. God again is understandably infuriated, and again, only the next day after this event. He tells Moses and Aaron to get out of the way so he can destroy the nation. Get out of my way. I'm gonna wipe them all out. Once again, in his wrath, God actually sends a terrible plague against them. But again, Moses, desiring to save the people, orders Aaron to quickly make atonement for them. So Aaron, as a clear type of Christ here, a mediator, savior, and deliverer, intercedes for the congregation, standing between life and death to stop the plague, which had already slain nearly 15,000 people. If you read in verses 48 and 49. Again, trying to intervene and help these people because they're so stubborn. Continuing in Numbers 17, God wants to finish this business of who's in charge of the priesthood in the tabernacle, as some were still questioning who could be a priest. So God instructed Moses to have Aaron write his name on a rod representing the tribe of Levi. And all the heads of the other tribe were to do the same thing. So all 12 rods plus Aaron's were placed before the Eternal in the tabernacle. Now in verse 8 it says, "Now it came to pass on the next day that Moses went into the tabernacle a witness, and behold, the rod of Aaron of the house of Levi had sprouted and put forth buds and produced blossoms and yielded ripe almonds. Then Moses brought out all the rods from before the Eternal to all the children of Israel, and they looked, and each man took his rod." End of matter. The priesthood was chosen by God, and in this case it was Aaron and his descendants. Put that matter to bed right there. Now, Numbers 18, it covers more responsibilities for duties and for Aaron and the Levites, but it also mentions that the tithe of the people of Israel were to go to the Levites, since they did not receive a land inheritance, and that the Levites themselves would have to give a tenth of the tithes that they received to the high priest. Numbers 19 now also deals with the ordinance of the red heifer and the water purification of sin. To meet the requirement of this Old Testament law, a red heifer was needed to help accomplish the purification from sin. Specifically, the ashes of the red heifer was needed. The red heifer was a reddish-brown cow, probably at least 2 years old. It was to be without defect or blemish, and to have never borne a yoke on its back. The sacrifice of the red heifer was unique law in that it was used, they used a female animal, and it was sacrificed away from the entrance of the tabernacle, and was only sacrificed in which the color of the animal was specified. Anyone who touched a dead body was considered to be unclean and would have to use this water mixture with the ashes of the red heifer to be cleansed. Now the imagery of this red heifer is yet another foreshadowing of the sacrifice of Christ for our sin. Jesus here was also without blemish, and just as the red heifer was to be. As the heifer was sacrificed outside the camp, Jesus was crucified outside the city of Jerusalem. And just as the ashes of the red heifer cleansed the people from the contamination of death, so the sacrifice of Christ saves us from the penalty and corruption of death. Now, some organizations make a big deal about the red heifer, especially since one that Fitz was actually born in 2008 in Israel. Now, why do they make a big deal about this? Okay, well, Jewish mystical traditions say the sacrifice of the red heifer only took place 9 times in history. Now, the last being some 2,000 years ago. Now, the 10th sacrifice will precede the rebuilding of the sacred temple in Jerusalem, allowing the purification of the Jewish people and signaling the coming of the Messiah. This is what they believe, and that's why they make a big deal about this. Take it as it's worth. I mean, that's just something that they believe. It's not something that's really biblical, but it's interesting that they foresee that this is something that they need to do. Now, this is actually going to conclude part one of this sermon. And we will continue next time in chapter 20 of Numbers, which actually jumps forward, a big gap in between here, which is a good breaking point. It actually jumps all the way forward to their 40th year in the wilderness, and we'll continue with that. But as you can see, there is much to learn about the actions of the Israelites. God explained that they were a stiff-necked or stubborn people. Many times they witnessed God's powerful handiwork, yet they still doubted and lacked faith. We tend to believe that we would not have been like them if we were there. But honestly, do you believe that we would feel different than them? I hope so. We who have not witnessed these great things can only learn from reading their story and how God reacted to them. And there's mention of that in, I think it's in Corinthians, I'm not sure the exact chapter or verse, but it says that what took place back then was an example for us to learn from what they did so that we don't do those type of things. It's mentioned a few times in the New Testament. So I think maybe we would have a little bit different view on it, but We just got to remember that Jesus Christ is our high priest and our mediator, and we need to fully rely on him and God our Father. There are times of trouble out there in the world, and right now in this nation, we see it constantly. God has called us out of this world just as he led the Israelites out of Egypt. How many times do we rebel against God with our actions? Do you plan on going back to the world? And are you scared of entering the promised land? Eternal life has been offered to us, and sometimes we may not truly comprehend what that really means. We have given much and had to give up much. We've been given much by God and had to give up much for this way of life, but not as much as Jesus had to give up for us. We cannot look back. We must continue to grow in faith and achieve the fruits of the Spirit that God is willing to give to us. We need only ask.